Arabic word that is using it, God reveals to you the namos, which he revealed to Moses. Namos probably is a Greek word, nomos, the same law in the sense of revealed law, revelation. Yalitani kuntu biha jali'an, if only I were a young man again. Wala in yudrikni yawmuka la ansurka nasran mu'azzara, and if I live long enough to see your time, the time when this affair becomes public, I will support you. If only I were alive, id yukhrijuka qawmuk, when your people drive you out. And he says, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, awa ukhrijiyahum, will they drive me out? And he says, lam yati qattun, lam yati nabiyun qattun bimithli ma jitta bihi illa udiya. No prophet has ever come with the likes of what you have brought without being persecuted. And then he died shortly afterwards. This is an important encounter, and a number of modern historians have wondered exactly who or what Waraqa was. And particularly they're wondering why the text in Bukhari says that he is engaging with the gospel in Hebrew. Some would say that's just a mistake, it must have been Syriac. But Syriac is something else in Arabic. And this says, Bil-Ibraniya. So a minor branch of scholarship has speculated that in Arabia at the time, there were the remnants of the first Jerusalem church called the Ebionites. If you've looked at early Christian history, you'll know that after Sayyidina Isa, alayhi salam, ends his earthly ministry, his community is led in worship at the temple by his brother, St. James. And they continue to worship and to practice as Jews. And the Gentile Christianity spread by St. Paul is certainly in tension with them. But then when the Romans destroy the temple a generation later, the remainder of the first church is dispersed into the Arabian desert. And we hear about these people for several centuries thereafter, and we know that these Ebionites believe in Jesus as Messiah, but they continue to follow a version of the Jewish law. And they didn't believe in Jesus as a god or somebody who died to atone for human sin. And so there's a lot of speculation that suggests that Waraqa is reading the gospel in Hebrew because he is from the diaspora, from the surviving remnant of that early Ebionite community. He's from the first church before Paul's ideas gain ground in Christianity. He believes in Jesus, but as a human prophet and as Messiah, not as a divine figure, and he's following some form of the Mosaic law. This is speculation, but if you look at a book on Islam by somebody called Hans Kung, he has 20 pages on this, explaining Islam is in continuity with what he calls Jewish or Ebionite Christianity. In any case, the story continues, the revelation continues to come. There is a period in which it slackens, but then it comes thick and fast. And after 3 years, the incipient Muslim community, which is gaining, as one would expect, converts from the poor, the slaves, the women, the natural Ishmaelite community, comes out. They've been meeting in the house of Al-Arqam, Ibn Abi Al-Arqam. And then there is public preaching, and following that, Waraqa's prediction comes true. And the community is persecuted. First martyr is Sumayya, radiallahu anha, but she is followed by others. So intense is the persecution that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam orders, particularly the weaker amongst his followers, to make the first hijrah, the first migration to Habasha, to Ethiopia. He himself remains in Mecca. There are times of sadness in the year of sadness, when his wife Khadija dies, and when Abu Talib dies, and when the Quraysh are offering him a very stark choice. We'll give you anything you want, is the basic message. Money, women, will make you the ruler, but just stop talking about what you've been talking about. Don't rock the boat. We're quite happy in our pluralistic world of different cults and deities. Stop rocking the boat. But he says, I'm willing to place the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left. I would not abandon this mission, this preaching. Towards the end of the period in Mecca, he is consoled, alayhi salatu wasalam, by an event that in many ways is the culmination of his ministry, and this is al-Isra wa al-Mi'raj. And again, it's recorded in a number of sound hadiths. And this is a well-known story. He is beside the Kaaba, and then he is taken miraculously from the great sanctuary in Mecca to the sanctuary in Jerusalem, where he meets and embraces the earlier great prophets and leads them in prayer, in a great symbolic moment that indicates that although he is at the forefront, he is affirming that he is their brother, and he is thereby establishing his legitimate connection, albeit as the Ishmaelite prophet, with the story of the city of Jerusalem. That again has momentous consequences for subsequent patterns of Muslim devotion and attachment to the place that becomes the third holiest place in Islam. And then he is taken up, Uruja bihi, in what is clearly the most mystically significant, the most mysterious dimension of his career. وَبِنْتَ تَرْقَى إِلَىٰ أَنِّلْتَ مَنْزِلَةً مِنْ قَابِ قَوْسَيْنِ لَمْ تُدْرَكْ وَلَمْ تُرَمِي. You continue to rise until you reach the degree of two bows length which has not been reached or aspired to by any other. Islam maintains two beliefs about prophethood, that the prophets are brothers and that their message is, in its doctrinal essentials, the same and identical, and that the salvation given by each prophetic episode is full salvation. But at the same time, the Holy Prophet has a primacy. And this primacy is demonstrated by the fact that he's their Imam in the Masjid al-Aqsa. And the fact that on the Mi'raj, he gets closer to the unimaginable, ineffable ultimate than any other. Even the angel cannot go further. Gabriel goes so far and then says, were I to go further, I would burn. And he goes alone, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, into that final unimaginable space. This seems to be what Surah An-Najm is referring to when it speaks of فَكَانَ قَابَ قَوْسَيْنِ الْأَدْنَى. He was two bows length, or nearer still, to the presence of the Divine. And that again is hugely formative for later Muslim piety because of two things. Firstly, the Sunnah is not just about emulating him outwardly. It's about seeking to fill those forms with a luminous reality. The outward form of his life changed the world and was spectacular, but it would not have changed hearts if it had not been overflowing with luminosity, the light that he first saw even before his 40th year when he was called to be a prophet. And the second aspect of the Mi'raj, which is formative for our spirituality, is that having been to that unimaginable point, unique, he returns. The text says, مَا كَذَبَ الْفُؤَادُ مَا رَأَى. The heart didn't deny or falsify that which he saw. His heart saw the divine majesty. But we are not told how or what that could possibly have been. We are simply told that this took place. But then, in a sense, the greatest miracle of the Mi'raj is that he comes back. And this is exactly the essence of Muslim spirituality, that we do not remain in some remote empyrean space, finally absorbed into some Buddhist enlightenment. We return to the world and engage with the world precisely because of what we have seen. The nature of prophecy is the nature of love. Why does he return? not because he prefers a dusty Arabian town to the presence of his Lord, but because he wishes, out of his love for his people, to share that extraordinary ultimate experience with everyone, even the hard-hearted Arabs. So not only is the world, as we say, created in love, and humanity created in love, but the mission of prophecy, and hence the whole Mu'amalat allowed of Islam, are also an expression of love. Why do we wish for human beings to be right with each other and with heaven? Not only because there's a set of commandments, but out of love. All of the ethics of religion are there so that human beings can be happy. That's the purpose, which is out of the divine and the prophetic desire for humanity. So he rises out of love for God, and he returns out of love for humanity, strengthened by the unimaginable experience that he has received. But still, the persecution continues. And then something new happens. A delegation comes from the city of Medina, and they've heard about him, and they come to visit the Kaaba, and they meet with him secretly, and they pledge allegiance in what's called the first bay'ah, the first pledge of Aqaba. And there's, it seems, six of them. They agree to accept his monotheistic summons. And they tell him about the situation in Medina. Mecca is stable under this plutocratic Quraysh regime, unified by the Kaaba and the cults around it. Medina has no Kaaba. It's as fragmented as Mecca is unified. And as I referred to yesterday, it's in a state of constant warfare, as the Arabs have been in a state of constant warfare, probably for tens of thousands of years, but Medina particularly acute. So they return the next year with a group of over 70, and they invite him. They summon him to come to Medina in order to act as an arbiter. They say the city contains pagans and contains Jews. You are neither of those things. You don't belong to any of the tribes in Medina. You can be a useful, impartial, external observer, rather like Stoltenberg being appointed as the Norwegian to resolve the warring factions in Bosnia, because he was from a different universe. He was invited, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, as a peacemaker and a power broker in the city of Medina. And he makes sure, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that the weak have all left Mecca, and that his disciples have all left Mecca, and he and Abu Bakr are the last. That's the sign of the good leader. Just as the captain is the last to leave the sinking ship, make sure that no one else is there. He also is the last with Abu Bakr to leave the city of Mecca. The famous story about how the Quraysh are outside with the long knives, and he makes his escape with Abu Bakr and hides in the cave of Thawr. These are stories that every Muslim child knows. And he arrives in Medina. That's the beginning of our calendar. And the arrival in Medina is, as I indicated yesterday, marked by this brilliant moment of statesmanship, his being invited as the arbiter, not as Rasulullah, because most of them don't know him as Rasulullah, they know him as an upright man from Quraysh who can be a kind of chief judge and resolve these disputes. And he finds his house in the dusty yard of the orphans of Abu Ayyub al-Ansari. And then, and again, the basic events of the seerah are well known. The Quraysh aren't going to leave him alone in the city of Medina. And they send an army. And the Battle of Badr ensues 2 years after the Hijrah. And although we think of the preaching of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam as being extraordinarily successful in the Medina period in Mecca because of the hard-heartedness and the solid religious structures of the city, not many people have actually responded. And so the number of people who are able to fight at the Battle of Badr is between 200 or 300. That's the most that they can muster, even after members of the people of Medina have started to convert. Abu Sufyan, the Generalissimo in Mecca is able to muster an army of over 1,000. But through human and divine interventions, the battle is won, and many would say the most momentous battle in human history. Because if it had been lost, that would have been an end to Islam. Mecca would have overwhelmed Medina and simply executed everyone. But through Allah's providence, Muslims were victorious, and as a result, we're here in Norway, and history was utterly, profoundly transformed as a result of what happened on that single day. The Holy Prophet والسلام, continues through his role as a broker or an arbiter to cement relationships, but he is also preaching, and in every tribe there are people who now believe in him, and the mosque in Medina becomes the first ever detribalized space in the city. Until that time, everybody has been absolutely sure exactly where the boundary of my tribe's territory and your tribe's territory exists. So this palm tree, that rock, that irrigation channel, that's the boundary between us. Now you have this unimaginable gift of monotheism, which says you're all equal and your tribe is irrelevant. Here is the haram, the sanctuary, the mosque of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And the young in particular people who have least to lose, again, the orphans, people who come in from the countryside, slaves, foreigners, Salman, Suhaib, and others, they join up with the new religion, and it becomes a new and radical and, for many, startling principle in the center of this intensely tribalized city, a completely neutral zone in which you're at the front of the mosque for only one reason, because you got there earlier. And that, of course, continues to be the greatness of Islam to this day. The mosque is a radically inclusive space, and the mosque in Medina, five times a day, includes at least 200 different nationalities. It's nowhere else, apart from Mecca and the planet, that is quite like that. So that initial uniting of the tribes continues to be represented in the cities of Mecca and Medina more than anywhere else on earth. And you're there and you have no idea what nationality you'll be praying next to, or it's radical human unity, which is, again, the gift of monotheism. The events of the Seerah, again, are well known, and it's one of the great